I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in January, Representative Liz Cheney, Republican from Wyoming, voted to impeach then-President Trump for his role in the riot and insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. She said, quote, "There has never been a greater betrayal by a president of the United States of his office and his oath to the Constitution." She was censured by the Republican Party in Wyoming and could lose her leadership job in the House of Representatives. She is not backing down, writing in the Washington Post yesterday, and I'll quote a few sentences. She said, "I am a conservative Republican. The most conservative of conservative values is reverence for the rule of law." She went on, "The question before us now is whether we will join Trump's crusade to delegitimize and undo the legal outcome of the 2020 election with all the consequences that might have." Joining us now is Susan Davis to get our conversation started. She is congressional correspondent for NPR, co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. And Susan Davis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Is Liz Cheney's days numbered as the number three Republican in the House of Representatives?
It would seem to be that way. It all happened rather rapidly this week. You first had House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy saying on Fox News that members had been raising questions about our leadership, followed quickly by the number two Republican, Steve Scalise, putting out a public on the record statement saying that he would support a colleague of theirs, Elise Stefanik of New York, to replace Cheney. Former President Trump quickly came out and endorsed Stefanik. She's rapidly gaining the support she needs for the job. She's unchallenged. And Cheney, frankly, isn't really fighting for it. She's not courting support. She's not trying to hang on. She's essentially daring her Republicans to throw her out of office. And this vote, as you note, is becoming much more of just about a leadership job. It's becoming a bit of a symbolic vote for whether Republicans are going to gloss over the president's actions around January 6th and his ongoing actions to undermine confidence in the 2020 election.
What is her job to be the number three person? What do they do?
The House Republican Conference Chair traditionally is in charge of party messaging strategy. It is the job that also has a lot of member services. It's really a job about keeping members happy. If the leader and the whip have to tell members what they don't want to hear, the conference chair is there to sort of work on party unity, what members should be saying when they go home for their recess breaks, what their priorities are. And in that regard, she's really been out of step with House Republicans when it comes to messaging. She's really been on a lonely island of just being absolutely relentless in countering President Trump every single time he attacks her or the election. She has used her leadership position to say he's wrong, this is wrong, this is dangerous, and this party should reject him if we want to have a future. That's a lonely voice. Most House Republicans remain loyal to the president. They're courting his support. And frankly, they think they need him on their side actively and publicly if they want to win control of the House in 2022.
You mentioned Minority House Leader Kevin McCarthy appearing on Fox and Friends. This was just a day or so ago on May 4th. Let me just play this clip. It's about 15 seconds, just so we can hear it directly from Leader McCarthy.
There's no concern about how she voted on impeachment. That decision has been made. I have heard from members concerned about her ability to carry out the job as conference chair, to carry out the message. We all need to be working as one if we're able to win the majority.
Is she by herself? I mean, most Republicans, of course, in fact, what was it, about 140 Republicans in the House voted to essentially say that Biden is not the legitimate president of the United States. There were a handful of Republicans that voted with Cheney. Do they stand with her on her stand today?
It's been relatively quiet. Of the group of Republicans that also voted for impeachment, she's enjoyed certain levels of support. One example is Adam Kinzinger. He's a Republican from Illinois. He's been equally as critical of the president, but he's not in a leadership role. But he put out a statement saying he supported Liz Cheney, that he would vote for Liz Cheney, and that every House Republican should go on record on this. She does continue to have significant support. I think it's just not from the Republicans that matter, right? Like, she has support from people like former Speaker Paul Ryan, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has donated to her campaign, Utah Senator Mitt Romney has been defending her. But these are not people that get a vote in this situation. The constituency here is the nearly 200-ish members of the House Republican conference, and they want her gone. And that is really the only votes that matter, even if outside of the conference, she might still have some level of support for her views, especially about the president.
Do people grouse privately or perhaps even praise her privately to you about what she's doing?
Frankly, the opposite. I think that more Republicans I've talked to in recent months have grown tired of her. And McCarthy's point is one that I think a lot of them share, that it wasn't just that she voted for impeachment. It's that she keeps continuing to criticize the president. That's bad for business. It's bad for fundraising. It makes the president angry. And Republicans, her colleagues, don't want to listen to her anymore. I think that she is taking what she calls a very principled stand. She sees a party that she no longer identifies with. She thinks that glossing over Trump's actions on January 6th and his continued effort to say that Joe Biden is somehow not the legal president of the United States is dangerous. In her op-ed in The Washington Post, she even said she thought it could provoke continued violence right. in the country for the president to continue to talk like that. So I think in this regard, she knows she's pretty lonely. It's not exactly like Democrats are rushing to embrace her. Her own party is distancing itself from her. I think one of the big questions for Liz Cheney is if she's removed from her office, as we believe it will be, what's her future in politics? Does she continue to run for re-election to the House? Can she win re-election back in Wyoming? And it's pretty remarkable where literally just months ago, she was seen as someone who had a very bright trajectory in the Republican Party. She's someone who in the past people have talked about as a possible presidential ticket material. She rolled out a Senate run a couple years ago, and that decision was seen as her deciding to sort of plant in the House and maybe try to chart a path to the speakership to become the first woman Republican speaker. All of that's kind of gone now, and it really comes down to Donald Trump. And I think it speaks to sort of the one litmus test for being an elected Republican in Congress right now is loyalty to Donald Trump. This isn't a policy debate.
Well, interesting. And let me just pick up on that. Donald Trump tweeted this week falsely claiming that he had won the 2020 presidential election. She tweeted, and I'm quoting here, "The 2020 presidential election was not stolen. Anyone who claims it was is spreading the big lie in all caps, turning their back on the rule of law and poisoning our democratic system." Just to underscore what you were just saying there, Susan Davis, which is that she is for her probably own reasons that she probably understands better than anyone else. She is not backing down.
No, and her statement is objectively true, right? This is not two opinions clashing against each other. The election was not stolen. It was a legitimate election. And the fact that she won't obfuscate that or at least remain silent over it, where I think many Republicans don't believe the election was unfair, they just don't want to take a counter position to the president because it's politically unfavorable for them. She's not willing to do that. And I think it just shows you how potent loyalty to the president is over all things else. I mean, Cheney compared to Elise Stefanik, both Republicans, but Cheney is a much more conservative Republican and has a much more conservative voting record. Elise Stefanik is more of a moderate. She voted against the Trump tax cuts. She voted against the signature policy issue of the Trump administration. But she has been a loyalist to the president, former president. She was a key defender in impeachment. She will not criticize him the way that Liz Cheney has. And that makes her Republican colleagues a lot more comfortable with having a woman like that in the number three position.
Why are Republicans, and we're talking about the House of Representatives, though, why are Republicans so undyingly loyal to the president?
Because most House Republicans represent districts that are microcosms of conservatism, not of the country. And their constituents overwhelmingly still support Donald Trump. They are not representing a national electorate. They are representing places where Donald Trump has 70, 80, 90% popularity, places where people want to see the president run again. They don't believe the media. They don't trust the election outcome. And to say the opposite of those things not only puts them at odds with Trump, but puts them at odds with a lot of their constituents. And I think Stefanik is a good example of that. She represents a district in upstate New York that was once a swing seat that voted for Obama. And now it has shifted towards Donald Trump, in which he comfortably won by a double-digit margin in the past two elections. So I think in some ways she's reflecting her own constituents, that they have become more pro-Trump and they're representing who their people are. And their people really support Donald Trump.
Well, as you mentioned, Liz Cheney, very conservative member of the House of Representatives from a very red state. I know that Trump won that state overwhelmingly. I don't have the exact facts and figures, but, you know, nonetheless, what do you think her future is in Wyoming, having really sort of laid down the gauntlet here?
It's really hard to say. I mean, Cheney is a tenacious, political savvy campaigner, and she still has a lot of structural support in the state of Wyoming. A lot of the money, a lot of the energy industry contacts, a lot of the donor base stands behind her, but they don't decide elections. She already has primary challengers. She was already censured by the state Republican Party for that impeachment vote. So I think it'll be tough. I think one of the key things to think about here is if you look at polling, vast majorities of Republican voters doubt that the election was fair. They do not believe that Biden was the legitimately elected president. And that's her constituency. So if she's trying to run for re-election among a group of people that fundamentally don't believe what she's saying is true, I don't know if it matters where she is on the policies. Even if she is a rock-rib conservative, this is really a dividing issue for Republicans. And she's just not willing to capitulate to that because she doesn't believe it's true and because it's not true.
What's interesting is Trump lost to Joe Biden. It was a pretty big win on Biden's part. Nonetheless, there were, I think Trump got more votes in 2020 than he got in 2016. And you also saw Republicans win races for the U.S. House of Representatives. So the Republican Party still has a lot of life left in it.
They sure do.
Even without Trump.
Absolutely. And I think when you talk to Republicans down the ballot, they did a lot better than they thought they were going to do in 2020. Yes, Trump lost, but they did in the House. They made much bigger gains than they thought they would. And that's part of what's contributing to this is that many top Republicans see Trumpism, not just the personality and the rhetoric stuff, but the way that he has shifted the party to be more of a working class style party, to be more skeptical of trade and things like that. They think he's remade the party and they want to move in that direction. So his imprint and his legacy is there's this talk of like, will Trump fade away or will he still have impact? I don't think there is a Republican actively running for office right now who underestimates the influence that Donald Trump could still have in these elections, especially with his endorsement or his opposition.
Susan, we're almost out of time here. When is the vote? Is it a public? Is it a private vote? What do you expect when they get back to Congress?
All leadership races take place behind closed doors. This will happen in secret ballot. We will know the top line tally of the vote, but we won't necessarily know who voted which way unless they tell us publicly. Cheney could decide to step down and not force the vote, but that doesn't seem to be sort of her positioning right now. This should come all to a head as early as next week and probably Wednesday when Republicans meet for the first time. They're on recess right now.
Well, thank you for getting our conversation started, kind of laying out the land here. Susan Davis, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And she is congressional correspondent for NPR, co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. And we will carry on this conversation, again, looking at the future of the Republican Party. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. There is a rift in the Republican Party. In one corner is Congresswoman Liz Cheney from Wyoming, who voted to impeach former President Trump, condemned him for undermining the results of the 2020 election, which he lost, and for his role in inciting the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol. She tweeted this week when Trump continued to claim falsely that the election was stolen from him, quote, the 2020 presidential election was not stolen. Anyone who claims it was is spreading the big lie, turning their back on the rule of law and poisoning our democratic system. In the other corner are a number of people, including Donald Trump, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Steve Scalise, and others. The Republicans in the House House are going to vote sometime about whether Cheney can retain her leadership position within the party, as we just heard. Well, today on Radio Times, this fight says about the GOP, why fealty to Trump has become the litmus test, and what this means for the future of the GOP. Joining us is Tim Miller, writer-at-large for The Bulwark, former communications director for Jeb Bush's 2016 presidential campaign, and former director for Republican Voters Against Trump. Tim Miller, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, good to be with y'all.
Nice to have you with us. And Leah Wright Rigger is Associate Professor of Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. She is, in fact, the Harry Truman Professor of American History, at Brandeis University, author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican. And Leah Wright Rigger, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome, and I should just underscore the fact you are not at Harvard anymore. You are at Brandeis. But we're happy to have you with us. Let me just make sure we can get listeners to join our conversation. That phone number is radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Tim, let me actually start with you. If Republican leaders successfully strip Liz Cheney of her number three position, this is obviously quite an important position within the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. What does that say about the party?
Well, look, I think that they are going to as early as next week. And I think that what it says about the party is something that we kind of already knew, which is that it's still enthralled to Donald Trump. It's enthralled to Donald Trump's whims and his lies more than it is a party that is united around any policy initiatives. Liz is likely to be replaced by Elise Stefanik, who I worked with actually at the RNC about a decade ago, who is a moderate center-right Republican, at least back then. She was for immigration reform and, was what they'd call these days a globalist, kind of in the Mitt Romney, John McCain mold, really. But she pivoted on Trump loyalty after he won in 2016 and became his biggest defender across two impeachments, one of his biggest defenders. She's a full-throated Donald Trump backer. Liz Cheney, on the other hand, is speaking the truth about what happened on January 6th and calling out Donald Trump's lies. She has a much more conservative voting record, is much more down the line, kind of Republican party line voter than Stefanik is. But she's the one that's being pushed out because she's out of step with the only thing that really matters to the party right now, which is complete fealty to Donald Trump.
And to you, Leah, are we talking about the Trump party or are we talking about the Republican party?
So I think it's hard to disentangle the two at this point. And I think Tim is exactly right to point out that fealty to Donald Trump is the number one issue right now. It's the number one criteria for being a Republican, or at least being a Republican with a prominent platform and leadership abilities within the party. With that being said, we also know that Donald Trump, there are certain things that are different about Donald Trump that are different or distinct from the Republican Party. And then there are things that are just the same, right? So we see people who are party line, voters when it comes to Donald Trump, but we also see people that break from the mold. But what the lesson that has emerged in the last couple of years is that without swearing loyalty to Trump, you will be punished. You will be punished, expeditiously and quite publicly, right? It's part of a ritual of punishment, of public kind of ridicule. So I think it sets up an interesting dynamic where we don't necessarily have to say, are there different separate Republican parties? And certainly there are warring factions within the Republican Party, but more so, what is necessary now to have power within the Republican Party or proximity to power is one criteria, which is loyalty to Donald Trump.
Well, let me pick up on that, Tim, and going back to you, is it that Trump and his popularity, as I understand it, is now in the 30s? It was mostly in the 40s, mid to upper and sometimes lower 40s when he was president of the United States. What is his power over this party?
Yeah, his power is bottom up, not top down. I think a lot of times we used to think about politics, particularly us in the political strategist class, as the kind of we were at the reins. You know, we were the puppet masters. We'd appeal to the base. You know, when needed, throw them a piece of red meat from time to time. But mostly we'd sort of, you know, steer the ship. What has happened in it's been driven by a couple of things, social media revolution, politics being funded by outside groups, being funded by small dollar donors more than big donors, is that the parties are really, you know, the tail is wagging the dog of these parties. Hmm. And what the voters want is complete support of Donald Trump. It's their most it's the most important issue when you poll them. It's kind of crazy when you ask Republican primary voters, what do they care about the most? It's, are you standing with Donald Trump or are you not? That's the thing that can change a candidate's, you know, success or failure in a Republican primary. Politicians respond to that. You know, politicians are trying to, you know, survive. And so, you know, no matter what their personal feelings are, you know, the evidence that they see based in polls, based in their colleagues who have tried to step out against Donald Trump, whether that's Jeff Flake or Justin Amash, or you could go down the list, is, you know, what the lesson that they've learned from all that is that they need to hold the line. That's what their voters want. And so that is really what's driving this more than, you know, judgment or strategy, or, you know, anything like that.
Let me play a clip, and this is House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. He's speaking on the House floor. This is back in January, and this is during the impeachment trial of then-President Trump. And this was just after the attacks on the U.S. Capitol. Let's just give it a quick listen.
The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters. He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding. These facts require immediate action by President Trump. Accept his share of responsibility, quell the brewing unrest, and ensure President-elect Biden is able to successfully begin his term.
Lee, a couple of days later, he said, I don't believe he provoked the riot, if you listen to what he said at the rally. You know, that's a 180-degree turn on what he originally said. In politics, can you get away with that? Apparently you can.
Apparently you can. And apparently people are. I mean, I think part of what we saw is that in the immediate aftermath of the Capitol riots, of that mob violence, of, you know, people putting gallows on the steps of the nation's capital, sacred ground, we saw politicians react naturally. We saw them react with fury. We saw them react with anger and in defiance in some cases, right? So the push to reassemble and get the vote done. But then as time passed, we see there's enough time for things to sink in. And I think the idea of sinking in about what it means to go against Donald Trump, what it would mean to say impeaching a former president, right? Or what it would mean to the party, to the base, to the grassroots. And I think that's when we began to see a lot of people back off. A lot of people do a 180, say it's over, it's done with, let's move on. Or no, the president didn't incite this insurrection or these riots, because the political cost of staying where you were, you know, during the actual mob violence and riots was far too high and the risk too high for many of these politicians. And so what they're doing is essentially pretending like nothing happened, like it wasn't a big deal. So we're not just seeing people do a complete, you know, 180 here. We're also seeing people say, well, it wasn't that bad. Or we're seeing people say, let's move on. We have a lot of revisionist history going on. And what's important here is that while I think this is happening amongst these kind of micro communities that together make up an important part of the Republican Party, an influential part of the Republican Party, for the rest of America, it's not holding weight. Donald Trump's popularity has plummeted amongst most Americans in this country, right? He's actually doing worse, and even amongst a small segment of Republicans. But the small segment of Republicans where he continues to hold clout are an influential group, and Republican politicians are really tied into that nexus or that network where they're thinking about how to move forward without acknowledging what actually happened on January 6th.
Let me just quickly reintroduce. We've got a lot of people who want to join our conversation. That's Leah Wright Rigueur, and she is the Harry Truman Professor of American History at Brandeis University, wrote a book called The Loneliness of the Black Republican. It's out in paperback. Tim Miller is with us as well. He is writer-at-large for The Bulwark, former communications director for Jeb Bush's 2016 presidential campaign, and former director of Republican Voters Against Trump. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at phone number 1-888-477-9499. Tim, let me just toss something back to you, and then I'll start reading some of the comments that are coming in. But I wonder, I don't know if you're still a Republican or, you know, where you stand in your relationship to the GOP, but when the Republican leadership is promoting a lie, a falsehood about an election, that is a, and this is what Liz Cheney is saying, but I think that's what a lot of other people are saying as well, is that is a true threat, not just to the Republican Party, but to the country at large.
Yeah, so after the November election, actually during the spreading of the big lie, I wrote an article for The Bulwark called Goodbye to All That, about leaving the party that I've been in since I was a very young intern at the governor's office in Colorado when I was 16 years old. And this was before January 6th. And I said, look, I knew that I was estranged or ostracized from the party, but I felt like it was worth fighting for through 2020. And you know, watching everyone's behavior after the election, I just didn't feel that way any longer. And obviously that came to a head on January 6th. I get myself a little out of whack with Liz Cheney and, you know, Mitt Romney and, you know, the few others, which is I'm not sure why they are not trying to think about, is there a way to wield power through a more center party? And it's not really, wouldn't really be a central ideological party, frankly. It would be just more of a party that wanted to respect Democratic and small r Republican norms throughout the country, and that could work with Democrats with that, and that would not vote for leadership that supported the insurrection as Kevin McCarthy did in the House. It might be something they might be forced into. I know that they're very reluctant to do that.
You mentioned Senator Mitt Romney. Let me just play one more clip. He was appearing at the Utah Republican Convention over the weekend, and he was booed. Let's just give it a quick listen.
It's a person who says what he thinks, and I don't hide the fact that I wasn't a fan of our last president's character issues.
And he ends by saying, aren't you embarrassed? I mean, Leah, I'm assuming if you're elected to office, you get used to being booed at particular events. But it's interesting. I mean, Tim Miller seems to be saying maybe these more moderate, and I should say that Cheney is not particularly moderate, but maybe these outsiders to the GOP could think of starting their own party. Is that even possible in 2021?
I mean, I'll just say that this one thing, that Mitt Romney now finds himself having a similar experience to that of his father, George Romney, who felt forced out of the, you know, forced out of the party in the 1960s and the 1970s. Very, very different men, and they govern in very different ways. But I do think that there's something really interesting about the parallel here of being a figure, a political figure, as your party is changing. And you're unwilling to change in the way that your party is changing and what that means for your career and where you are. And certainly, yes, it means that you are used to being booed. It also means that you're used to being trailed in airports, harassed on airplanes in the middle of a pandemic in this case. And I think part of what a lot of people hold on to is this idea that functionally they can't fix the party if they are not within it. Right. And that they believe that the party is still worth fixing. But I think there's something clear that's happening here that is really important and a reflection of a changing or a party that is in transition as it searches for its identity, which is that this party is not going to change even if there are those within it who are committed to reforming it. So it's not going to change in the direction that you need to go.
Sure,
I totally
sure.
agree with that. And if I could
go ahead, Tim.
Really quick. Yeah, just really quick. I don't think that as long as Joe Biden is president and governing from the center left, that there's really room for a third party. My suggestion was a third caucus in Congress, frankly, for Romney and Liz. And I think that, you know, who knows, things might change down the line. But I don't think that with Joe Biden as an alternative, that a third party is really viable.
Tim, here's an email from Stu who says the GOP has been going in this direction for decades before Trump. Americans should rejoice that they have finally been revealed. Do you agree with that? Boy, I mean, here it's all out there for us to talk about, right?
Yeah, I really disagree with that. I do not agree with the notion that, I'm not saying that this all came out of nowhere with Donald Trump and he just sort of emerged and is solely the cause and effect. I think obviously that some of this was brewing within the Republican Party. Some of it bubbled up, obviously, through the Tea Party. Pat Buchanan's runs in 92 and 96, you can see a lot of echoes of this. But the notion that a John McCain presidency would have been the same as Donald Trump's when it comes to lack of respect for the rule of law and immigrants may have had other flaws. You may disagree with John McCain and his foreign policy, and other things. I'm certainly happy to talk about that. But I think the unique nature of the assault, frankly, on our democracy that is being led by Donald Trump, it really is, I think, a category change from disagreements that you may have had and mistakes, by the way, that Mitt Romney may have made trying to assuage these forces in the party in 2012. At this point, kind of these darker, anti-democratic, bigoted forces now completely control the party. I do not think that change is a good thing, no matter what you think about the flaws of the past.
Let me read a couple of comments here, then we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. George says, when a major political party gives up on truth and democracy, America is in danger. Comment from Andy is, if Liz Cheney is removed from her position, leading to even greater domination by pro-Trump supporters, why should non-Republicans regard the GOP as anything other than fascist or proto-fascist? A comment from Dean, this isn't the first big lie that the Republicans have engaged in. Remember weapons of mass destruction. Remember the ties between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. Those Republican big lies led to 500,000 dead Iraqis. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation with Tim Miller and Leah Wright Rigger. And I will read more of your comments if you send them to us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone to join our conversation. We're talking about the future of the Republican Party. 1-888-477-9499. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the future of the Republican Party, the fight within the party between Liz Cheney and some of the leadership in that party. Our guests are Leah Wright Rigger, the Harry Truman Professor of American History at Brandeis University, author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, out in paperback. Tim Miller is with us as well, writer at large for The Bulwark, former communications director for Jeb Bush's 2016 presidential campaign, and former director for Republican Voters Against Trump. Leah, both of you mentioned John McCain came up from our listeners as well. And I've always felt that McCain's selection of Sarah Palin to be his vice president kind of laid the groundwork for the nomination election of Donald Trump. Do you see it that way?
Well, I like to think of it this way. Imagine what an election would have looked like in 2008 if instead of Sarah Palin, John McCain had selected Colin Powell, or Colin Powell would have allowed himself to be selected. I think we would have been talking about a very different vision of the Republican Party. And certainly it's a vision that comes up over and over again amongst the group of reformers within the Republican Party. It's central in the Republican autopsy report that comes out in 2012 and 2013, but it's one that the party continues to reject. and continues to reject for a whole host of reasons that we can get into. And I'm sure Tim has some opinions on that as well. But one thing that I'll say here, too, is that in a lot of ways, not only does Sarah Palin lay the groundwork or the blueprint for somebody like a Donald Trump, but she in her contestation or clashes with John McCain set up a dynamic that revealed the crisis, the two different factions, or at least two of the many factions that are constantly at war within the Republican Party about the direction and the vision of the party, and one segment of the party that continues to lose, or at least has continued to lose at a greater rate, allowing the Sarah Palin vision of the party to continue at a much faster speed.
What do you think, Tim?
So I've been thinking about this a lot lately because I'm working on a book about how this all happened.
Okay, very good.
I could come back and discuss
okay,
that.
Okay, fair enough.
I think that, so I was working for John McCain in 08 on that primary campaign, and there was a lot of evidence of this disconnect between party leadership and the base then. I remember, the events, the town hall events we would have in Iowa, and just question after question about immigration and illegal immigration and trade and the NAFTA superhighway conspiracy. And so I think that the Palin choice was a mistake and may have supercharged the path towards this direction. But I think we were heading this direction because that's what base voters in the party wanted. And I think that really, if you look globally at this, it's the direction that conservative parties are moving all over the Western world, right? Towards this more, it's really making the Republican Party mimic more the European conservative parties. So I think the Palin choice was, of course, a mistake. I think it was hard for McCain to predict at the time just how much of a populist firebrand she would be. Since she hadn't been on the national stage before he picked her. And I think that kind of it didn't really matter in the grand scheme of things, even had he picked, Tim Pawlenty or Joe Lieberman like he was thinking of. I think that probably would have just created even more anger within the Republican base voter and would have eventually ended up somewhere, maybe not Trump himself, but something like this.
Let me quote from Liz Cheney's piece in the Washington Post yesterday. She says, while embracing or ignoring Trump's statements might seem attractive to some for fundraising and political purposes, that approach will do profound long-term damage to our party and to our country. To you, Leah, sort of knowing that the country is becoming more diverse, seeing that Biden won, black voters overwhelmingly, that certainly happened with other Democrats as well, independent voters, suburban women, is, as you look at the sort of the future of the Republican Party, can it survive with these demographic changes?
Well, one thing that we know is that demographics is not destiny. And so we also know that the politicians will go to great lengths, even as their voter base pool is shrinking, to keep power. And they will find all kinds of creative and really interesting and perhaps eyebrow-raising ways in order to maintain that power. We've seen it before, we've seen it in the past. And I think one of the things that we see in the 2020 election that is directly linked to this idea of the big lie is kind of this idea that Trump has been propagating over the last 5 years, which is that, if voters that support Democrats, then those votes must be illegitimate. They must not be valid. They must be fraudulent. And I think one of the things that I would highlight is that in 2020, part of the case, this kind of legal case that the Trump team used, and we all know that it was full of holes, it was kind of a mess, but the rhetorical legal argument that they made was that places like Detroit, places like Philadelphia, places like Atlanta must be full of fraudulent voters because those voters represent a changing demographic within the United States. So we're talking Black voters, we're talking Latino voters, we're talking young college voters. So we see that political parties come up with all kinds of creative ways to either oppress or depress voters, particularly in the face of demographic change. One other thing that I'll say here, too, is that we can't count on this idea of the Republican Party going, completely to the right, completely down the avenue of anti-democratic forces and things like that, or even, toying with racism and bigotry to discount being able to appeal to Black voters and Latino voters and Asian American voters. We did see some growth amongst the Republican Party, and part of that is a reflection of the fact that there are always going to be some racial minority voters who support Republicans. So sure, that can't be the only thing, right? It's a complicated question. But yes, they will find a way to maintain power, even as demographically they are losing the race.
And picking up on that, Tim, and this is speaking broadly, speaking about a number of states, it looks like Republicans in a number of these critical states have decided that putting more regulations and trying to deal with the, you know, false problem of voter fraud is a way that they can win races by reducing the ability to vote.
I for sure, this is the overt strategy they've come through. And I think that this is the reason why. So you mentioned earlier that 2012 autopsy about expanding the Republicans' tent. I was at the RNC and worked on that at the time. You notice they didn't have an autopsy this time. And I think that's because the party looks at the way that the Electoral College and the Senate is set up. And they see that based on their advantage with white working class voters, they have a structural advantage that can help them in the Senate, also lesser degree in the House and in the Electoral College. And if they combine that with voting rights restrictions, that this is a path towards having majorities and winning the presidency potentially while still being a minority party. I would just caution. I think that if you noticed the what happened with working class Latino voters this past election, that the Republicans do also see opportunity there. And a lot of times when you have culture war fights that fall on educational lines with, you know, higher educated, more elite voters, you know, arguing one thing in a culture war fight, as we saw a lot with COVID restrictions, where things, obviously everything has to do with race, but where race wasn't the central issue at play. You are going to see working class, particularly men, in you know, communities of color, be attracted to that. And I think that the Republicans see opportunity there. They, despite losing this year, saw some positive movement among Latino voters, particularly men. And I think that is their other strategy in addition to the voting rights restrictions.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from George. He says, your guest says this was not the party years ago because John McCain wouldn't have governed that way. Well, John McCain didn't win. Neither did Mitt Romney. George goes on to say, think that might have to do with the fact that they weren't as nuts as the Republican base. And he answers his own question saying, yes. Chris says, I feel like we're watching a party of Trump driven by lies, hatred, and alternative reality via Fox as a GOP conservative party eating each other alive. Isn't it obvious that they are different parties? It seems like the actual rise of a new party. Picking up on what was said earlier, Leah, you want to respond to that?
Well, I don't necessarily think it's the rise of a new party. I think it's a continuation of the modern Republican Party, but parties undergo evolution. The Democratic Party has undergone multiple evolutions. The Republican Party has undergone multiple evolutions. What's important to point out, though, is that at any given point during that process of evolution, the Republican Party in this case has the choice to go in a different direction. Oftentimes, they choose not to go in that direction. They choose to go in a direction where they are melding, right, in this case, with Donald Trump. So it is, you know, we've had all of these conversations about, is this the party of Trump? Is this not the party of Trump? Are they separate parties? Are they different? Are they warring factions? Yes, they are warring factions, but it is the Republican Party. And right now, the Republican Party is undergoing a transformation and an evolution into the party of Donald Trump. He is the most popular Republican in the country. He is also the biggest fundraiser, and he has the biggest platform and the most power in the party right now.
I wonder, Tim, though, whether Republicans are losing an opportunity to criticize what Biden is doing. I mean, he's spending lots of money. He has clearly taken a page, at least from the progressives within the Democratic Party, I think probably surprising a lot of people on climate and family leave, and there's a long list of policies that he has put out there. And it seems Republicans are arguing about who is woke, or what does it mean to be woke, or what about Mr. Potato Head? Are they missing an opportunity to take on the Democrats on policy issues?
Probably, but the party's united in the culture war. They're not united in a fight on policy. There have been real changes in the makeup of both parties. There have been this sort of college-educated suburban voter that used to be a swing voter, vote Republican, has now moved to the Democratic Party. Trump brought in these new working-class white voters, used to be kind of union voters who used to vote Democrat or voted for Perot maybe. Those voters don't care about government spending, right? That is not a priority for them. They want government support and government benefits, particularly when it helps them.
Sure.
And so the Republicans in Washington, I think, are on shaky ground about what exactly to do with their new base voter, right? With this new voter that Donald Trump has brought in. They know that they need their vote, but if they start railing against government spending, that might turn them off. And so I think that you'll see when Biden really goes overboard, Republicans push back on that. We're not in 2010 anymore, where there's this big fight over economic spending. That's not where the Republican Party is. And so I think that's why you'll see them focus more on the issue at the border and the culture war fights, where everyone within the coalition is united and try to navigate how to deal with Biden's spending. And I think that gives Biden, frankly, an opportunity to push more spending, than maybe he would have had the party been more still been an economically conservative, fiscally conservative party, rather.
Former President Trump does face a number of legal challenges. I've kind of lost track about the number of potential lawsuits that he's going to have to address. Do you think in any way this would undermine support that he has within the Republican Party?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Okay.
And I think one of the things that this has shown us is that Trump is remarkable at spinning things to work in his direction. And I think Tim is exactly right in showing that these new voters or these old voters who have been converted, who are kind of coalescing around the identity of Trump and Trumpism more broadly, right? Trumpism as an ideology that exists and doesn't need Trump, don't see that as something that is important. They see it as another example of, say, leaders or elites or in corrupt institutions trying to bring down the man they see as their figure, right, as their central figure. What did seem to damage Trump in a way that has been unexpected amongst his base was that January 6th Capitol insurrection and those Capitol riots. And I think for most people, the reason why that was so damaging and so damning in a lot of ways is because it was unequivocal that the president was egging on an attack on American democracy that is unprecedented, at least in the modern period. We just haven't had something like that in the 20th and 21st century. Certainly, in earlier days, when politics was far more, far more violent, I think. But we're essentially comparing what happened on January 6th to a civil war. And when we're doing that, it tells us that something is fundamentally wrong. And I think that was a line in the sand for a number of people, but unfortunately not enough people, and certainly not enough people, not enough Republicans in Congress.
We're almost out of time, Tim, but I just wanted to do a quick quote from something Michael Gerson wrote in the Washington Post. He said the GOP is increasingly defined not by its shared beliefs, but its shared delusions. To be a loyal Republican, he said, one must be either a sucker or a liar. I mean, those are really harsh words, and no one wants to be lied to. What do you make of that?
Look, I agree with that. There's no argument that if it was not for Donald Trump's lies that January 6th wouldn't have happened. There still would be all these problems we've been discussing within the Republican Party coalition, but had a more responsible leader acted after the November election, what we saw at the Capitol wouldn't have happened. These voters are being lied to, and they believe it, and they continue to believe it up to this day. So I agree with what Michael Gerson said. I would only add to it that I think they are also united by their shared grievances. And I think that is what really unites the Republican Party right now: grievance against the left, grievance against Hollywood, grievance against the culture that they feel is moving against them, grievances against big tech, grievances against immigrants and minority communities. It is an anti-party. It is not a party that's for anything. And, you know, when you look at go-to focus groups of Trump voters, they're very, very, very deft at explaining all the things that they're against and all the people that they're against, but not as deft about explaining what they're for.
Well, we have to leave it there. Leave it there. Tim Miller, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Leah Wright-Rigger, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm Marty Moscowen, and thank you for joining us on Radio Times.